This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Okay, so we just did an exercise that I would claim develops mindful awareness. And if you were listening to the guidance, then you know my definition of mindful awareness. Would anybody care to state it? Concentration, power, sensory clarity, and equanimity working together. A woodcutter wakes up in the morning and has a job to do. The job is to cut down trees. So what does a wise woodcutter do before starting to do that job? That person has a job, a responsibility, there's something to do. But if they're wise, they don't immediately just start flailing away at the trees, right? What do they do first?
Sharpen the axe.
They would sharpen their axe. They would sharpen their tool. There's a tool to do this job. When I titled this talk, The Purpose of Life, I was not actually intending to speculate on the philosophical, theological debate about what's the purpose of life. That's not really something that I am qualified to talk about or actually particularly inclined to, to talk about. But I did have in the back of my mind something sort of like the purpose of life, a way of thinking about the human situation. And that way of thinking about the human situation is that in the big picture, the really, really, really big picture, we human beings have three jobs to do in this life. One might say that we have three and a half jobs, actually. We have three jobs, and then the half job, which some people never really realize, is to realize that these three jobs are actually the same job, not competing with each other, but actually complementing each other, and they are part of the same endeavor. The reason I wanted to give you a nice dose of meditation practice, however, before beginning to talk on this topic, is that we want to be like the wise woodcutter. Okay? We want to, in order to fulfill our three jobs as human beings, we have a set of tools that vastly, vastly, vastly potentiates our ability to achieve those three tasks in our lifetime. But unless we hone those tools in a systematic way, they're not going to be of much use to us. So I would say that in the big picture, the issue of human happiness is to understand three very large tasks that were assigned when we're born, and to understand the three tools that we have that will allow us to achieve those tasks, to understand how to hone those tools, to keep them, to sharpen them and make them powerful, and to understand that the three jobs are part of one job. And you can already get a little hint that that may be the case, because the exact same tool set is applicable to each of the jobs. So here's how I describe the three jobs, and this is how I think about my own life. when I think like, okay, what am I here? What am I doing? Why am I here? What do I have to do in the big picture? There's a lot of specifics, of course, but looking big picture-wise, what are my tasks? Confucius said, first and foremost, cultivate the root. The leaves and branches will take care of themselves if you cultivate the root. So the three jobs that I'm thinking of, these are the root jobs. So the first job I describe as, and you have to listen carefully because the words are extremely carefully chosen, to appreciate the self and the world sensorially. To sensorially appreciate yourself and your world. So I'm going to have to then tell you or give you a way of thinking about what is self and what is world sensorially, tangibly. So the first job is appreciate self and world as it arises, as they arise in the senses moment by moment, including right now. Appreciate the self and the world. Second job, get over the self and the world. For real. No kidding around. Industrial strength. Not as a philosophy, not as a feel-good, warm and fuzzy, but industrial strength, get over it. Transcend it. Find a place outside of time and space that you can access on demand. The Buddhist word for that is nirvana, which means cessation. So get over the self in the world. Transcend the self in the world. So that sounds like a pretty big job. So maybe riding upon this, you can guess, okay, we had self and world, right? Appreciate the self and the world sensorially, just as they arise. Ordinary experience. Get over the self and the world. That sounds pretty extraordinary. Self and world, appreciate, get over. I'll bet you can guess what the third job would be.
Transcend.
Well, we just did that. That's get over. Transcend, see beyond, just synonyms for get over. What's left
Return.
Out of the picture?
Return.
Involve.
Yeah, that's the general direction, but let's make it parallel. Let's say self and world, and let's put a transitive verb in front of it so it all matches.
Improve self and world.
How about that? Improve the self and the world. That sounds like a pretty laudable task. Now, a lot of people would start improving the self and the world without necessarily thinking about appreciating the self in the world or transcending the self in the world. I would suggest to you that the endeavor to improve the self in the world, just doing that one single job without some awareness of the other two jobs and their relationship to that job of improving the self in the world, I would suggest to you that if you don't include the other two jobs in some way, that your efforts to improve the self in the world may end up to be less than optimal. Particularly the efforts to improve the world without some sense of how to appreciate things just as they are, and some sense of how to see beyond things. Without that, the attempt to improve the world may well be subject to what I call the three outs: burnout, bum out, freak out. Okay, so balance. Okay. And I said it's three and a half jobs, that one half job is to realize that although these three jobs may sound like they're taking you in opposite directions or they're competing for your energies, the final job is to see them as one job, one endeavor. What unifies this endeavor in the way that I like to think about things is mindful awareness, which I define as Was anyone listening?
Concentration,
sensory clarity, and equanimity working together. Now, if you've ever heard any of my talks or you've been on the internet or read my stuff, you'll know how I define these three things. Well, I don't actually define them because that ends up being circular. But what I do is I give you an idea of what I'm talking about. So you can think of concentration power as the ability to focus on what you deem relevant anytime you want for as long as you want. Does that sound like a useful skill?
Yes.
What?
Yes.
More people don't agree with me? How many people think that sounds like a useful skill? Okay. I think that's a useful skill. I think that's about the most useful skill that a person can have, because any other skill that you might want to acquire is going to be somewhat dependent on your ability to concentrate. So it's at the base of the pyramid, so to speak. But what's wrong with this picture? That's a skill no one ever told you. Well, they told you, but they never told the average human. The average human never knows that their base level of concentration power can be elevated through systematic practice, just like your base level of physical strength can be elevated through systematic exercise. So what's wrong with this picture? Or we attempt to acquire all sorts of skills without acquiring the basic skill first in school and so forth. It's like, well, the kids can't learn because they don't know how to concentrate. But they could be taught to concentrate in interesting ways and have that generic skill. So the exercise that we did, when your attention wandered, I had you come back to the breath pleasure. But I could have had you come back to a mantra or a visualization or observing your mental images and mental talk or observing your physical and emotional body sensations. We could have returned to anything. But by returning, we would be developing generic concentration power. Once again, you can think of concentration power as the ability to focus on what you deem relevant for anytime you want, for as long as you want. Notice there was absolutely nothing in this definition that implied that one must necessarily be focusing on something small. Okay? A lot of times people think, oh, concentration means that it's contracted. Yes, there is a contractive flavor of concentration, but there's also an expansive flavor of concentration. The ability to hold all sensory experience at once, for example. If that's what you deem relevant, that would be an expansive flavor of concentration. So I gave a very careful definition that avoids many common preconceptions about the nature of concentration. Concentration power. Sensory clarity. You can think of sensory clarity as the ability to untangle the strands of sensory experience. Why would that be useful? Well, a lot of reasons. What would be some reasons why it might be useful to untangle the strands of sensory experience? Maybe you haven't thought that your sensory experience is tangled. But once you start paying close attention, you'll notice that there is a lot of tangling, actually. Well, let me tell you a story. So many years ago, I had a student that had a fear issue. Fear was an issue for her. And she asked me to give her a leader and some guided meditation that would help her be able to deal with fear more effectively. So what we needed was to have controllable fear on demand, right? So I decided, okay, let's go to a scary ride. We're going to go on a scary ride, and I'm going to give you a guided meditation while we go on this scary ride. So the morning that it's the time to go on the scary ride, I wake up and I realize, you know what? Actually, I'm a little scared. And I said, okay, so I better meditate myself. So I start tracking as I'm bopping around in the world, because we're going to go later in the day, but it's morning. So I start tracking my fear. How do I track it? Well, how do I know I'm afraid? What, remember I said appreciate the self and world sensorially? Well, how do I know I have that right now I'm a frightened self? How do I know that tangibly through my senses? Well, I'm getting these mental images of the ride and it, like, you know, crashing. I'm seeing these headlines of prominent Los Angeles Buddhist teacher killed in freak accident. Okay, I'm getting these mental images. I'm getting this talk about, God, how am I going to guide her when I'm already sort of freaking out a little bit? And no, come on, you know you can handle this. Back and forth, right? So I've got the mental talk about the fear. I've got the mental images. And what other sensory component might be going on in addition to the visual thinking and the auditory thinking? Yeah, yeah, you got in the, have you ever noticed? Yadda yadda da, bang, bang, bang in the body, right? It yadda yadda da, bang, bang, bang. It goes off in your talk space, it goes off in your image space, and then that triggers the juices in the body that are the actual sensation of primordial animal fear. So I'm tracking see-in, tracking my inner seeing of mental image, hear-in, my mental talk, feel-in, my inner emotional body, locally and globally, and I'm sort of tracking my fear ebbing and flowing, and everything's fine because I can keep track. Oh yeah, this part is mental image, this part is mental talk, this part is the emotional body. And then it's like, okay, now we're going to get in the car. And the images are coming a little quicker, and the talk's a little bit louder, and the body is a little bit more intense. And there's both a global spread as well as the local sort of splashing of fear sensations. But it's still all manageable. I'm noting, you know, see and hear and feel, and I'm keeping track of all this. And then we arrive at the location, and we sort of like see, right, the scary ride. And things intensify. Okay, we're good. Get in line. And meanwhile, I'm also like guiding this person in the same technique. And that's quite doable. And then we get in the thing, okay? And they sort of like lock you in the thing. And it's like a cage, and it's like this, you're restrained inside this thing. And I freak out. I like totally freak out. It's like, I'm out of here. I'm suffering, and okay, like it's real now, and I've lost it. Now, here's the insight piece. At that instant of freak out, okay, see, there was a sequence. At the instant when I lost it, when I was overwhelmed, there was a dramatic quantum change. Prior to that, the image, the talk, the emotional body were growing in intensity, and I was tracking them. At the instant of freakout, I completely lost all ability to note what part of this fear is image, what part of this fear is mental talk, what part of this fear is the emotional body. It became, in the classical Sanskrit term, a mishmash. That's a joke. A gamish. Oh, better still. Okay, so some, we know the ethnicity of the ones that come. Okay, so these are Yiddish words for it. It means all mixed together. Okay. It was completely tangled. Now you can bet that those components were there. They were there to the max. But I could not tell you at that instant of overwhelm which part was image which part was talk, which what part was emotional body. And then what I had, it took me about 10 minutes of guessing and just forcing myself back and trying and trying and trying. And then finally, I could resolve it again. I could say what part was this, what part was this, what part was that. Sensorially, nothing changed. All those components were there, they were getting more and more intense, but at some point, there was this sudden disappearance of the ability to keep track of what was what. They completely tangled. And at the moment of tangle, that was the moment of overwhelm. Conversely, the moment of untangle was the moment when overwhelm ended. And I would suggest to you that you can try this experiment over and over again. It's an empirical truth. It means it's not true for any philosophical reason, it's just true. It is an empirical truth that when your mental image, mental talk, and your emotional body get tangled, you will become overwhelmed and identify with that state. And when they get untangled, the overwhelm will go away. Furthermore, if the untangling is sufficient, if you really, really, really untangle them, because unfortunately, they're tangled at many scales, not just one scale. So to really untangle these elements actually is quite a demanding task and a time-consuming task. But if you really untangle them, not only does the sense of identification and overwhelm go away, but an illusory perception called self as thing, sakkaya ditti, in the words of the Buddha. Sakkaya ditti means the perception that there is a thing inside me called a self. At sota apatti, at stream entry, which is initial enlightenment, sakkaya ditti goes away. That's the way that Theravada Buddhism formulates the initial experience of enlightenment. And how does it go away? It goes away because the elements become sufficiently untangled. So that this illusion that there is a thing called a self vanishes. So it turns out that there are both quantitative and qualitative negative consequences of the tangling. The qualitative negative consequence is overwhelm. I'm sorry, the quantitative negative consequence is overwhelm, okay? This sense of suffering. The qualitative negative consequence is subtler. The qualitative negative consequence of tangling is that perception that almost everyone has, that there is a thing inside me called a self. So that actually goes away when there's enough sensory clarity. And what is equanimity? Equanimity is the ability to allow experience to come and go without push and pull. How many people have ever had an experience like this? You're in some sort of physical or emotional discomfort, and it's getting worse, it's getting worse, it's getting worse, and for whatever reason, at some point, you fall into a state where you're just not fighting with it anymore. And even though the intensity level may not change at all, the perceived suffering, the perceived problem, suddenly and dramatically lessened. How many people have had that experience? Everyone that raised their hand had an experience of spontaneously falling into equanimity. That's very significant. But what most people don't realize is that just as you can develop your concentration skills through practice, and you can develop your sensory clarity skills, your untangling skills through practice, you can develop equanimity through practice. How many people here have ever had this kind of experience? There was something pleasant, but because you were tightening so much about it, maybe worried about not getting enough of it, or not getting it, or that it would pass, that actually that pleasant experience was unpleasant. Okay? Then everyone that raised their hand has experienced the negative consequence of lacking equanimity with pleasure. Okay, the opposite of equanimity is grasping. So it turns out that equanimity works both ways to our advantage. It reduces the perceived suffering when we're uncomfortable, and it elevates our perceived fulfillment with pleasure. However, that's the good news. Now let's look at the other news. What's the flip side? The flip side is, well, you could have a small discomfort, but if you have no equanimity at all, or if you're in great interference, push and pull, on that discomfort, your perceived suffering may be huge, even though the discomfort is small. And also, even though you may have very strong pleasure, if you don't have equanimity with it, it may not give you fulfillment. How many pairs of shoes will satisfy you if you don't know how to be, if you don't know how to be satisfied, if you don't know how to taste satisfaction with one? Well, no amount of increasing the pleasure is going to help, because you're not seeking pleasure. You don't know it, but what you really want is fulfillment. And fulfillment is pleasure multiplied by mindfulness. And suffering is pain divided by mindfulness. And mindfulness is concentration times clarity times equanimity. Do the math. Okay. So does it make sense that these three skills would allow, or let's put it a different way, in order to experience the self and the world in a high state of appreciating it sensorially, do you need to be able to concentrate on things? If you want to experience a sandwich, eating a sandwich, that's part of the world, right? So do you need to be able to concentrate on that? Do you need to have sensory clarity? Do you need to be able to let that pleasure come and go without interference in order to have a complete experience of eating a sandwich? That's part of the world. Well, now just take any other part of the world, the same is true. So to have to appreciate the world sensorially, we need these skills. How about to appreciate ourselves? A lot of people have an issue around themselves. They can't just let their thoughts and emotions come and go, arise as part of nature. There's just a lot of viscosity in the arising of self. That happens naturally in the world. It also can actually happen as the result of Buddhist practice. One of the problems that can develop in Buddhist practice is that because the Buddha talked about no self, that we can get in a habit of thinking of suppressing the arising of the self. But the way that we come to understand no self is by having a complete experience of the self. And I would claim that in order to have a complete experience of the self of the moment, it's very useful to have those three skills. You need to be able to focus on what's producing the sense of a self. So what produces the sense of a self? Well, broadly, self is mind-body experience. Broadly. But can we sort of subdivide a little bit? Well, the mind, I just pointed out to you that at least on the surface, we can make the mind tangible the way the world is tangible. How do we know there's a world? Where we see it, we hear it. Guess what? When we have thoughts, there can be a visual component, tends to sort of center around here. There's an auditory component. So there's mental image and mental talk. Those are tangible sensory events that can be tracked in real time that constitute at least the surface of thinking. Now, what about the depths of thinking? Well, that's a longer conversation that we don't have time to have right now, but I would be happy to talk about it on some occasion. So we can divide the mind into see in and hear in. What about the body? Well, there's the physicality of the body, but then there's a whole class of sensations that are very significant for human beings. They are body sensations. They have locations, qualities in the body. Their intensities come and go. They are the body sensations associated with anger, fear, sadness, embarrassment, impatience, disgust, interest, joy, love, smile, humor, gratitude, etc., etc. The emotional body sensations. Now, a case could be made that broadly, anything that we experience as body is self. But also, if we wanted to cut the pie a little bit differently, we could say that those emotional sensations are particularly related to self, as opposed to the physical sensations. Sometimes it's useful to chop it up that way. In order to appreciate the world, you would have to be able to have a concentrated, clear, and equanimous experience of the sights, the physical sounds, and the physicality in your body. We can call that the world from a certain point of view. And we could call your thoughts and emotions, the mental image, the mental talk, and the emotional body, we could call that the self. Now, I would claim that to have a complete experience of your, to appreciate yourself just as it is, would be to experience your mental image, your mental talk, and your emotional body in a state of concentration, clarity, and equanimity. So I would claim that in order to achieve this first goal, the goal of appreciating the self and the world sensorially, as they arise in the moment, that the three skills are very useful. So this will elevate your sense of fulfillment and diminish your sense of suffering. So this is appreciating the self and the world using the three skills, which together constitute mindful awareness. So what about transcend the self in the world? That's interesting. A monk once went to a Zen master and said, how do you go beyond hot and cold? Okay? So imagine you were that Zen master, and a monk asked you, how do you go beyond hot and cold? First of all, what is the monk actually asking? Are they just asking about hot and cold? No, they're asking about all dualities, right? They're asking about hot and cold. They're asking about future and past. They're asking about self and other. They're asking about heaven and hell. They're asking about good and evil. They're asking about God and the devil. they're asking about how do you go beyond Abraham Lincoln and Adolf Hitler? Okay? They're asking a lot. So, if you were that Zen master, what would you answer? Well, that particular Zen master, on that particular occasion, said, why don't you go to a place where there is no hot or cold? Why don't you just transcend hot and cold? Okay? So now we come to the crux of the issue. The monk said, tell me about the place where there is no hot or cold. You understand that the place where there is no hot or cold is nirvana. In early Buddhism, or as my teacher Joshu Sasaki Roshi once put it, it's that place where Hitler and Roosevelt enjoy a convivial cup of tea together. The monk asked, "Tell me something about that place." Now, what's the Zen master going to say? Now, I'm not a Zen teacher, which is probably good for you, because I can actually attempt to explain to you that place. But the Zen master is not going to explain in this circumstance. So they might sometimes explain, but usually not. Definitely not in this circumstance. But the Zen master will give you the answer. But it will require you to exercise your own intuitive muscles in order to understand the answer. So when a good Vipassana talk, you leave, everything is crystal clear. A good Zen talk, you leave, you are totally confused, but you have equanimity with don't know. Which leads to wisdom mind. There's several ways to get to wisdom mind that are very contrasting. In Vipassana, we get to wisdom mind through careful observation. But in certain schools of Zen, you get to wisdom mind through having equanimity with confusion. Letting go of the need to know on a consistent basis so that a new kind of knowing can arise. And that leads to the same wisdom as the careful observation, although you wouldn't think so just on the surface, because the methodologies are so contrasting. This cultivating intuitive understanding through letting go of the need to know has been independently discovered by three cultures, historically, as far as I know. And the first was the West. A long time ago, the ancient Greeks called it epiche, E-P-O-C-H-E. You can look it up in an unabridged dictionary. It means suspending the need to know. It means the systematic suspending of the need to know in order to know in a deeper way. It was then discovered in China, in Chan or Zen, and they use sometimes these strange questions like, show me the sound of one hand clapping or something like that. Okay, it's like, what? I don't know. Just keep that. And then it was rediscovered in the West by the Christians, who called it docta ignorantia, carefully cultivated not knowing. The cloud of unknowing. Deus tam quam per ignorantium cogniscibus, said St. Thomas Aquinas in Latin, the language of those days. If you want to know God directly, it's through a special kind of not knowing. You can read a book called The Cloud of Unknowing. It was written in the 15th century. Meditation manual for Christians. All based on don't know mind. So, three cultures independently discovered the same technology. Anyway, let's get back to our three tasks. So the Zen master has now been asked to say something about the place where there is no hot and there is no cold. And what does he say? When you're hot, you boil to death. When you're cold, you freeze to death, is what he says. If you understand this, then you understand how to get over the self and the world. What does it mean? What does it mean boil to death or freeze to death. It means to have an experience of something that is so concentrated, so clear, and so equanimous that you are so busy experiencing it that there's no time to fixate it into a thing. It means escaping into the self and the world by having a complete experience of the self and world. So guess what? Getting over the self and the world is merely the extreme case of appreciating the self and the world. If you heard that, you got your money's worth for a whole lifetime. The limiting case, this is math speak, okay? The limiting case is like, how far can we take this in the limit? If you had calculus, you know what you've heard this phrase, okay? So in the limit, what's the limiting case of appreciating the self in the world just as it is sensorially, which I define as experiencing it in a state of concentration, clarity, equanimity simultaneously, that taken to its extreme will directly point you to that which is beyond time, space, beyond self and world. You're so engaged in it that there's no time to thingify it. It becomes a verb, it becomes a wave, and, you know, chunks of matter will just sit there, but waves well up and subside. Not seen because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. When the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of glory, and the fire and the rose are one. Who said? You got it, T.S. Eliot. They don't give out those Nobel Prizes for literature for nothing, huh? That's how his great work, The Four Quartets, ends. And it is absolutely a description of nirvana. And it tended to be so. He was a student of Buddhism. But it's also a description of the Christian view of things. Okay, so it turns out that in the extreme of appreciating the self and world just as they are, they will turn into a wave and then that wave will cease. And you will be that wave. And then you will be that cessation. And then when the self and world return, as inevitably they will, they won't look the same. Anybody here ever listen to that Leonard Cohen song, Love Itself? When I came back from where I'd been, the room, it looked the same, but there was nothing in between the nameless and the name. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leonard studies with the same person I study with, the person I've mentioned several times, Sasaki Roshi. That's Leonard's version of Sasaki Roshi's description of enlightenment. Most people don't know that, although he says it right on the album cover. He says to our teacher, Joshu Sasaki Roshi. He actually puts it on. It's right on there if you look carefully in the fine print. Love went on and on until it reached an open door. Then love itself was gone. And that gone is not a negative. Okay, that's the gone of nirvana. That's the gone of a complete experience of love. Okay, so we've covered job number one. Appreciate self and world as they arise sensorially, just as they are. Job number two, transcend self and world is just the limiting case of appreciating the self and world, at least in the way I like to look at things. The most extreme example, you've loved yourself to death. Literally. Right? When you're hot, you freeze. You boil to death. When you're cold, you freeze to death. So now what about the third job? Improve the self in the world, which completes the spiritual path. Well, how do you improve yourself? Well, it's hard to... Well, let's put it this way. It's hard to improve the self if you're completely caught up in the self. But if you have a place to stand that's outside of the self, then it makes it a lot easier to improve the self. The concentration, clarity, and equanimity help you have a bit of a place to stand outside of the self. They are the core skills that people need to improve themselves. What does it mean to improve ourselves? Well, it means to change behavior patterns, but what drives behavior patterns? Behavior patterns are driven by mental image, mental talk, and the physical and emotional body. And the extent to which you're experiencing fulfillment there and not experiencing suffering there, to that extent, your behaviors will be appropriate. And to the extent that the opposite is true, that there is suffering, physical and emotional, and non-fulfillment, physical and emotional, in the body, to that extent, that's going to drive and distort behavior. So it turns out that the core skills of concentration, clarity, and equanimity are very related to the endeavor of improving ourselves, refining ourselves, becoming a better person in the ordinary sense of becoming a better person. So that's improving the self. How about improving the world? Well, why would we be motivated to improve the world? A lot of reasons. Let me give you just two. They're pretty big, though. I'll give you three. First, it's natural. Confucius said that we're born good. We're born with a quality that in Chinese is called ran. It means our intrinsic goodness as a human being. And then that gets covered over. So, but it doesn't get completely covered over. So most people have some sense that they want to be of service to others. And of course, to the extent that you're coming out of suffering, and your core skills are central to that endeavor, to the extent that you're coming out of suffering, your natural goodness will be revealed. So that's a reason for serving. Another reason for serving is that in order to develop the skills to the degree that I'm describing, in order to develop mindful awareness to the degree that you actually start to taste that which is beyond hot and cold, pardon my French, but most people have to go through a lot of shit for a long time. Okay, have you noticed? Meditation can be a bear, okay? Shit comes up. You have to deal with stuff. And boy, do I remember. I mean, I was... Now I get to tell the, in my day, okay? I get to tell the war stories. I feel this pleasant self-referential sensation. But at least I'm having a clear, concentrated, equanimous experience of my ego pleasure telling you about my war stories from the old days in Japan. Old school Zen, that's how I started. A long, long time ago, 1970. And they made you sit in the full lotus, and you couldn't move, not an inch, for an hour, and no matter what. And I my whole body would shake, and then I would start to lose my mind, like literally go insane, like have like deluded, paranoid thoughts and so forth. And it just went, I mean, it was years of that, years of that. And I used to think, this is Looney Tunes. Why am I putting myself through this? This is crazy. This isn't the middle way that the Buddha taught. This is, you know. But then, in retrospect, I realized, even though it seemed like it was just crazy and pointless, it left a seed inside of me that I will never forget what misery is. No matter how deep my practice gets and how blissful things are, and, you know, I got to admit, after 40 years of this stuff, hey, you know, it's pretty good. But there's a memory that's engraved within me of what it means to be clueless and abject in suffering that I just will never forget. And that's inside, that's going to be inside each and every one of you. All the things that you're going through, all that struggle that you go through where you have the self-doubts and it's just like going through mud and it seems like you're not making progress and you got it and I don't got it. Okay. If you stick with this, there's a very high probability you will achieve your three jobs. But all that you're having to go through in the initial phases of your practice, that's sowing the seeds for a life of compassionate service. So that's reason number two for service. And reason number three, the place that is beyond hot and cold, that is the source, the nothingness, whence we come and whence we return, moment by moment. Most people don't realize it, but in the time that I've been talking to you, thousands and thousands of times, we've come from and returned to that source, unconsciously. But if you're conscious of it, then you know that the zero, the nirvana, the emptiness, the source of consciousness, whatever you want to call it, that you experience is the same that every being experiences. And the person that we share the womb with is called, in Greek, Adelphos. That means brother or sister. Literally means sharing the womb. So once you have an experience, you might think that the experience of emptiness would estrange you from humanity, but actually it has exactly the opposite effect. It connects you to every being. And so that when you look out at the world, it seems like you're looking at yourself. And therefore, what's the natural thing to do? What's the next step? Well, there's this larger self to liberate, which is everyone. And that's called bodhisattva, bodhicitta. The bodhisattva aspiration arises from the emptiness. If you look in the classic Buddhist text, there's this weird thing about the emptiness is related to the compassion, and you wonder, it doesn't make any sense. Why should it be? It should be the opposite. It should make you cold and non-human. But that's the central mystery of world mysticism that every culture has discovered independently is that this particular form of contact with the impersonal nurtures the best within the personal. Contact with that which is not good or bad, not past or future, okay? Contact with that nurtures and refines within us the best of the human. And so that's where that spirit of service comes, and that's improving the world in whatever way that you can, whatever is appropriate to your situation. So that's the basic point I wanted to make. We've got three skills, and any human being can develop those with competent instruction for people that know what they're talking about. And you practice, and there's a pretty good probability you'll be able to elevate your mindful awareness to the point where you can fulfill these three jobs. And of course, another way to describe that is to say that as the result of this, you will be happy in the deepest and broadest sense that the word happiness can be used. And that's all I have to say.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.